flight into icing and what really happened on board Flight 3407. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into the Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. As is the case most Mondays, my guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. We're here to talk about a couple of topics Bob brought up in the current edition, the March edition of Over the Airwaves, which is available on the web at overtheairwaves.com. Bob, thanks for taking some time out. As always, we appreciate your being here.
Thanks, Paul. My pleasure.
You talked about making good sense about flying in sub-freezing clouds in the current edition of Over the Airwaves. And I know that this is a somewhat of a hot button topic that has come to be over the years associated with the name Bob Miller. I guess the question I'm left with after reading this is, how do we choose the right freezing cloud?
And I'm going to turn that question around and ask you another question. How do we determine the right level of low visibility? How do we determine the right level of turbulence when we go out? I put icing conditions or sub-freezing clouds in the same category as poor visibility, the same category as turbulence. That is, like turbulence, like visibility, like sub-freezing clouds, there are ranges of conditions that run from nothing to severe. Mm-hmm. And so recently, as you know, the FAA has redefined their definition of what they call known icing conditions. Up until very recently, the FAA took the position that if the cloud temperature was below 32 degrees Fahrenheit, 0 degrees Celsius, that fact alone, sub-freezing clouds, constituted what would be regarded as known icing conditions. Translated, if the outside temperature was below 32 degrees and we were about to penetrate a cloud in a non-known ice certified airplane, we are on the verge of violating FAR 91.9, which deals with the aircraft certification limitations, which would preclude that airplane from going into known icing conditions. What I've tried to point out, and I think to the credit of the FAA, they've taken a different stance on what constitutes known icing conditions and said it is not temperature alone that defines known icing, but there are a whole series of factors, all of which come down to what the pilot's judgment is when he gathers and assesses all of the information pertaining to those clouds. So there are ways that we can tell before getting into a cold cloud whether it contains icing, and there are ways in which to deal with cold clouds that do contain icing that if we do a bit of advanced planning are perfectly safe. On the other hand, if we do not do advanced planning and we're not properly trained, then we're playing Russian roulette with a condition that can, in fact, kill. So it's not a question of black and white, can we or can we not go into cold clouds. It's much more a condition of grays, and just like it is when we're about to enter areas of turbulence or areas of low visibility.
Well, now, Bob, you have a really interesting diagram in the edition of Over the Airwaves that came out for this month that talks about these additional meteorological factors. Temperature between 14 and 32 degrees Fahrenheit, high humidity, air rising at a particular rate, and the size of the water droplets. How many of these things can we detect? Or are we waiting for technology maybe to devise a way that we can have something mounted on the outside of the airplane that will detect this particular combination that leads to icing?
Well, each of those conditions, water, vapor size, temperature, disturbances in the atmosphere all count. But I also used a metaphor or a reference to a totally unrelated profession when I asked my dentist, for example, what safeguards he takes when treating a patient that has AIDS. And his quick response was, I treat all patients as if they have AIDS. And I translated that back to, let's, as pilots, consider all sub-freezing clouds to contain lots of ice. Now, they all do not contain lots of ice. But if they do, and we regarded them as same, that still doesn't preclude us from going into them, but there has to be some immediate back doors available to us. And this is really part and parcel to the whole subject of what we're talking about. If, for example, we cannot get to VFR conditions within minutes after penetrating known icing conditions, then don't go in there. Or if we cannot get to warmer air within minutes, then don't go into those clouds. And both of those conditions must exist above the minimum vectoring altitude. But even before going into the clouds, there are certain things that we can look at. For example, if we're about to take a trip from point A to point B, and somewhere along the trip, we're going to pass through a low pressure area or a front, beware. The likelihood of light to moderate, even possibly severe icing is very high. On the other hand, if we're going to go from point A to point B, and we look at the surface analysis, and we're making no frontal passages, we're not passing through any low pressure areas, the air is very stable, then the likelihood of encountering airframe icing in conditions like that are significantly lower. So we can begin to assess just by a careful pre-brief and understanding what conditions do precipitate ice or cause icing. Combine that with having back doors that are readily accessible, we can get greater utilization out of our airplanes. Now, Paul, as I say this, we have to contrast this with the black and white definition. You can't go in the clouds if they're below freezing.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as flight instruction is concerned, that black and white definition says, I don't even want to talk about it, students. If it's sub-freezing, don't go there. And of course, that kind of instruction just leaves the pilot totally unprepared and untrained in the event that something different happens than planned along that route of flight.
Well, and as you point out, it makes an airplane not of enough use to justify its costs.
Well, sure. It turns it into a part-time seasonal vehicle,
mm-hmm.
and we can't have that. And what's more, now we have a whole new line of airplanes coming out that presumably are icing capable. We have TKS systems now coming out on the Cessna 400. We have de-icing condition TKS on the Cirrus SR-22. In fact, they have the certification now on the SR-22 for known icing conditions.
Mm-hmm.
But that does nothing to help the pilot who inadvertently penetrates moderate to severe icing. Even those systems will not keep him safe. And unless he has some good foundational instruction on how to deal with those conditions, then he can't go there. And then if he can't go there at all, why did he spend $40,000 on a TKS system? You know, all of this begs the question, we must recognize icing or clouds, cold clouds, in the same context as we look at turbulence and as we look at low visibility. There are shades of gray, and we have to be prepared to deal with each of those shades.
All right, Bob, when we come back from the break, let's talk about Flight 3407, which was the Continental Connection flight operated by Colgan Air that crashed short of the runway in Buffalo a few weeks ago. I know that you have some definite thoughts on that and some of the things that have followed in the media since then. Bob Miller is my guest of Over the Airwaves. We'll be back with more in a moment. I'm Paul Plack. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
This is a story of two pilots. Our first guy, the one with Garmin Waas GPS, he just arrived home from a trip, ready to enjoy a nice home-cooked meal with his supermodel girlfriend.
Chérie, viens près moi.
But our other guy, the pilot without Waas, well, he couldn't quite make it home. Had to divert to an airport with an ILS approach. So now it's dinner from a vending machine in some crummy pilot's lounge. You know which pilot you want to be. Garmin Waas GPS. Follow the leader.
Chérie.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot, talking about icing and in particular now about Flight 3407, which was that regional turboprop that came down short of the runway in Buffalo a few weeks ago, landed on a house in Clarence Center. 49 lives on the plane lost, one on the ground. And Bob, I know you have some very definite thoughts on what has followed in the media. And let me just mention a couple of things. No less than Jim Hall, former chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board, has called for all turboprops to be grounded in icing conditions. And while a lot of attention has been paid to the fact that he's the former NTSB chair, very little attention seems to have been paid in the media to the fact that he now works for a law firm specializing in aviation litigation. What do you feel about this? I mean, some airlines seem to have been tempted to buckle to this pressure the same way, you know, business flyers have to the stuff that Congress has been throwing around.
Well, to me, the most frustrating aspect of 3407 is the fact that we have two pieces of technology, both of which, when looked at together, can really give us the final answer as to what happened on 3407. The first piece of technology is the flight data recorder. The NTSB has given us colorful animations of just what that airplane was doing based upon information supplied by the flight data computer. The other piece of technology, which mysteriously in this crash and many, many other airline accidents in the past, that other piece of technology is known as the CVR, the cockpit voice recorder. Now, the NTSB has been mum on that subject. In fact, the entire industry, as far as I can see, has been mum on the subject. There's a rule that certainly every airline pilot is well aware of and most GA pilots have heard of, and it's called the sterile cockpit rule. And that means that a cockpit crew can discuss nothing between themselves from the ground to 10,000 feet and from 10,000 feet on the descent back to the gate engine shutdown. Something happened on 3407 that caused the crew to be distracted from one of the instruments that every pilot going through basic airmanship 101 learns to study from day one, and that is the airspeed indicator. Now, everything that we learn from the flight data recorder suggests very strongly, or tells us very strongly, that that Q400, while under the control of the autopilot, was permitted to slow to stall speed. Why it slowed to stall speed, for any number of reasons, but likely because it was contaminated with ice. The crew had said that there was, quote, significant, close quote, ice building up on the windscreen. So the airplane was indeed slowing. It was the autopilot was likely pitching up, trimming up to hold its final descent assigned altitude of 2,300 feet. Meanwhile, the airspeed was decaying slower and slower. Why did the stick shaker all of a sudden have to be the one piece of technology to alert the crew to do something? Once that airplane fell below 140 knots, 130 knots, 120 knots, the crew's attention should have been riveted to either putting the nose down or adding power. Now, that hasn't been revealed at all in the flight data recorder. So were they, in fact, distracted by some other conversation in the cockpit? And I don't think anybody can answer that question until the NTSB comes forward with the transcript of the cockpit voice recorders. Why they haven't done this is a good question, and I think somebody really needs to ask it.
Well, in the meantime, an entire category of aircraft has been, painted with this brush that they're not safe in the winter or not safe in icing conditions and should be on the ground. And the fact is, another Q400, also coming from Newark, on the same route, at almost the same time, made a perfectly safe landing, you know, moments later on the same runway. The other questions, I guess, involved are, is there anything inherently wrong with turboprops in ice? And, you know, Jim Hall was very critical of these, pneumatic de-icing boots that he calls 1930s technology or antiquated technology. You know, what's the deal there?
Well, if Jim Hall were to have his way and you carried that to the ultimate end, then following that logic, no propeller-driven aircraft with pneumatic boots ought to be allowed to operate in sub-freezing clouds. That is ludicrous, absolutely ludicrous. Now, the point that I think somewhat tangential to Jim Hall's point is, I would argue that it probably takes a bit more piloting skill to fly a turboprop Q400 through icing conditions than it does to fly, an RJ or any turbofan airplane, simply because there's less margin for error in this type of airplane. And unless he is telling us that, you know, airline pilots are basically, inept at flying anything that isn't fully automated, that they do not have the ability to manage something as complicated as a Q400, then, well, that's a different issue altogether, and that goes back to the standards that we have to uphold for flight crew proficiency and competence. There's nothing wrong with the airplane. In fact, I'm a little surprised that Bombardier hasn't jumped on, and perhaps they have, on the issue of the cockpit voice recorder. You know, nobody wants to go out and point fingers, and certainly nobody wants to go out and hang this on the pilots. Goodness knows, we pilots get blamed for almost everything that takes place in the air. And in many cases, we should, because there was an oversight. But I have to go back to the basic question, Paul. Why was this airplane permitted to slow to such an extent that it was near stall before there was any pilot intervention? Why wasn't the nose lowered minutes earlier than the stick shaker went off? Why wasn't there an increase in power just to maintain that precious flying speed that was decaying, likely because of ice?
Well, hopefully we'll find out some of these things, Bob. And obviously the NTSB's final report on probable cause is not going to happen anytime in 2009 if they go on their normal schedule. But hopefully we'll see these transcripts coming out fairly soon. And in the meantime, should we feel safe flying these things in the winter?
There's no question. There's no question that we should feel safe as far as the aircraft is concerned. Now, you know, this raises in my mind, you know, what level of crew training are these regional providers, regional carriers given? Now, that's the subject of a whole other discussion that you and I might have. But that's at issue here, not the airplane themselves.
Well, and now you're talking about a reason why a lot of people might not want to see this transcript come out. I mean, when you think about it.
Yeah, when you think about it, that very well could be the reason.
All right. Well, Bob, as always, thought-provoking stuff. We will catch you again next Monday.
Thanks, Paul.
The current edition of Over the Airwaves, the Journal for the Proficient Pilot, is the March edition. You can find it at www.overtheairwaves.com. My guest has been Bob Miller. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.